I thank you for joining us this evening. If you would go ahead and open your Bibles, the book of Leviticus. We're not going to be reading the entire book or Numbers tonight, but we will pick up a few things. And as we talk about the Bible, when we talk about the Old Testament, and especially what we've been doing of recent, more of an overview or a big picture in the Old Testament, you had one of these from Genesis and then one from Exodus. And as I promised, they're not going to be one per book. In fact, this is two books in one. Moving forward, we're going to have a few other books put together. But for now, Leviticus and Numbers are the next two books in the Scriptures to deal with. And the word, when we're talking about Leviticus and Numbers, really regards to wanderings. Up to this point, we have witnessed the beginning of creation, of all things into existence. And then we witnessed how God was beginning to take the Israelites from the land of the Gentiles and through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, bring them to the land of Egypt. And we saw in Exodus how God brought about the situation that would result in them coming out of Egypt, potentially up to 5 million strong. They go from 75 to 5 million in about 400 years. And then in Exodus, we witness their departure and some of the things that God tells them. And then some really incredible things happen in Exodus. The Ten Commandments are given, as well as talking about the tabernacle, which we'll do in the near future. And the book of Leviticus, to a large degree, carries forward. And while before we were talking about, 400 years or 40 years in, or 80 years, I suppose, in Moses' case, in Exodus covers, we said, 400 years, which is true, because the beginning of Exodus is still talking about those 75. And at the end, you're at the end of Moses' 80th year of age. But then something happens with the Israelites. God intends to take them into the land. God's purpose, what we'll see in just a few moments, is that he intended on giving them the land of Canaan about 3 to 5 months after they started their journey from Egypt. And yet, when they reach that place where they would cross over the Jordan into the land, they refuse to go. And you can argue there's a lot of reasons why they would refuse to go, but regardless, what should have been a series of months turns into 40 years. And to the broad stream of things, you might think 40 years is a small blip. I mean, on your picture up here, it's a really small, narrow little sliver of time, but that's an entire generation of people who have rejected God's will. And this is the punishment that they would endure because of it. 40 years are covered in Leviticus and Numbers. It's a super small sliver of time considering the length of the book. I mean, these are two ginormous books. But it covers only 40 years in the history of the Israelites. But an important 40 years of things that take place. When we look at the 2,000-year time span, the 2,000 is about the time Abraham comes on the scene, and about 1,700 or so. But you have, 400 years leads into these 40 years. We talked about those 400 years and all that took place in just a matter of a couple of chapters. And now, something like 63 chapters for just 40 years seems pretty crazy. When we talk about the facts of Leviticus and Numbers, we look at just the facts. The books, interestingly enough, the book of Leviticus means having to do with the Levites. Their naming conventions were really lacking. The book of Leviticus just has to do with the Levites, so they named it that. The book of Numbers is about counting because it revolves around the numbering of the people. About two numberings, one at the beginning and one at the end. We had a numbering when they left Egypt, and they have another numbering in the book of Numbers. And it's about the waxing and the waning in truth. It's about the waxing and the waning of their numbers. and how they struggle sometimes and how they are successful in growing in their kingdom. It's written most assuredly by Moses. Again, the book of Leviticus is 27 chapters. The book of Numbers is 36 chapters. They begin at Mount Sinai, which is why it's so easy to put these two together, not just because they revolve around one generation of human beings. The next two books following will revolve around the next two individual or the next two generations. But it begins at Mount Sinai. After the people had received the law, the Ten Commandments in particular, and much of the moral law, God starts in Leviticus, teaching them about how they're going to worship Him, how they're going to live their lives for Him, how they're going to dwell. And then they begin their journey. And the book of Numbers carries that journey forward, and the book of Numbers ends at the border of the Promised Land. When we talk about the book of Leviticus, because it behooves us to separate them into two at this point, the book of Leviticus, if you outline the book in a generic way, on the left are the chapters that involve the events that are on the right, or the persons. The first nine chapters of Leviticus are about the sacrifices and offerings. By the way, most of the art on this page is done by my daughter. I commissioned it. Normally, it's much brighter. I'm not sure what happened in the printing. My apologies. But it makes sense that the spy would not be seen very well. I mean, that just sounds thematic. The first nine chapters about the sacrifices and offerings. Nine chapters dedicated to sacrifices and offerings of the goings-on of the tabernacle and then later the temple. In chapter 10, you meet two characters that we talk about a lot, Nadab and Abihu, who decide to walk into the temple. And potentially, because they're intoxicated, considering the command that God gives Aaron afterwards to never, ever, ever come into the temple if you're drunk, seems to conclude perhaps they were intoxicated coming in, which is why they did such a foolish thing in bringing strange fire. Which also really gives us an indication on how serious God is about His worship. When you worship Him, you worship according to spirit and in truth, we understand from John chapter 4, verse 24. Jesus says that very thing concerning the Father. So we should not take worship lightly. And they did, and they suffered the consequences. Fire from heaven comes down to consume them. Following that, interestingly enough, chapters 11 through 15 are a series of chapters concerning cleanness or holiness, which in the Old Testament, we talked about before, is connected to spirituality, but they needed to make a connection before that, right? You bring people along, you teach them physical purity so that they can understand spiritual purity. And they did that. God teaches them physical purity and how physical purity applies. These are all the rules regarding not growing crops, two different crops in the same plot of land, or wearing garments that are made of two different materials, on and on and on. All kinds of teachings and laws concerning holiness and purity. And the reason for those laws was simply to communicate the importance of those two concepts, to explain them in a physical way so that we could understand them in a spiritual way. So cleanliness and holiness. And then he ends there 16 through 27 with the ceremonial and moral laws. The goings on in the temple are talked about in a number of places and concerned with a number of things. As we move to the book of Numbers, the first nine chapters, Numbers 1 through 9, are numbering the people. Yes, it takes them nine chapters to number the people, in part because you have the 12 tribes, but there's potentially 5 million people there. And they have to list all of the names and who is involved in this tribe and who is involved in this tribe and who is this family and who behooves this and begets that. And as such, it takes a long time. These are some chapters that are incredibly difficult to read through. I don't encourage people, especially early on, to read through these chapters. They're not particularly necessary for New Testament Christians, but they are important. And I can't stress that enough. These chapters are important because they, among other things, they certify and detail the heritage not only of Jesus, but of everyone who would follow these individuals in Numbers, who would need to show where they came from, what tribe they were a part of, or where their ancestry comes from. And as such, those things are wildly important to the future of Israel. Sure, maybe not for us, but definitely for them. And as we've been talking about in Sunday morning Bible class, being redeemed required a lot on God's part. And he went through a lot in order to make sure that it took place. Jesus coming in the flesh, dying for our souls. In chapters 10 and 11, I say life goes on because we return to the normal. And sadly, that normal is the Israelites complain. They spend two chapters complaining about one thing or another. They complain probably about the heat and the sand and where it gets. They complain about eating bread all the time. They complain about water, and God takes care of some of them and not others, tells them to be quiet and occasionally shushes them. But you get the idea. In chapter 12, Aaron and Miriam revolt against Moses. We talked about this a few weeks ago concerning the humbleness or the meekness of Moses, and how when they decide to go effectively and try to usurp the authority or take some, we're going to take some of the burden off you, Moses. And God's like, no, I gave this to Moses. It's not for you to decide who's responsible here. This goes into what we were talking about this morning in regard to the eldership. Who is responsible, right? Who is the one that's supposed to have authority? Well, God determined that. If he hadn't, then it would be up in the air, perhaps. Perhaps we'd be able to judiciously decide, or maybe we would vote on it. But that God didn't tell us to vote. God said, this is how it's going to be done. And if it's done that way, then it's according to his will, and we should respect it and honor it. And they needed to respect and honor that Moses had been chosen. A really fantastic section in chapters 13 and 14, the spies are chosen. There's actually a song about it. 12 spies went into Canaan, 10 were bad and 2 were good. What did they see when they spied on Canaan? 10 were bad and 2 were good. Some saw giants 10 feet tall, others grapes in clusters tall. Some saw God was in it all. 10 were bad and 2 were good. It's a great song. I'm not going to sing it. My throat, I don't think, could handle it, but I would normally. So you guys get out of that one. You're welcome. Right? Some, and I love the end, some saw giants 10 feet tall. They could see nothing else. Some were so focused on the clusters of grapes that they found that they saw nothing else. And two of them saw that God had it. God had taken care of it. God was working in this. And they said, yes, there are clusters of grapes that are bigger than my head. And they said, yes, you're right. There are giants in the land, but God is with us. Sadly, at the end of the accounting of these 12 spies, the 2 good and the 12 and the 10 bad, the people of Israel decide not to go into the land. And when God tells them, fine, you won't go into the land, they rebel and do the thing that God wanted them to do at the beginning, but they refused. And when they try, God smites them. He says, fine, you won't go into the land. And maybe they thought we'd wait a while. Maybe they thought we'll train some. Maybe they thought we'll grow in number. And then we'll go back. It didn't matter. Because none of those things mattered. None of those things were important. What was important is that two of them saw that God was in it all, and they were not moved to pursue God's will. God told them, I'm bringing you into this land. I'm giving you this land. It is yours. And I'm going to be your God, and I'm going to take care of you. And yet, they did not listen. In chapter 16, we meet a man named Korah and many who follow him, who believe that they should be the high priest, or maybe believe that it should be elected official. It didn't matter. And God had them throw their staffs down, and when Aaron's rod budded, it demonstrated to the rest of Israel that he was the one who was chosen to lead Israel in the spiritual realm, that is, in worship as the high priest. And Korah and those who followed him, the ground is opened and they are destroyed. God is not one to be trifled with. Chapter 21, It's on both slides, but chapter 21 pertains to the bronze serpent, which was discussed this morning and demonstrated, as we talked about this morning, demonstrated faithfulness among the people. A very large bronze effigy of a serpent on a staff or a cross, perhaps. And Jesus discusses that in John chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, as Larry talked about this morning. And the reason for that bronze serpent is a demonstration of faith. If you believe, then you'll do what God calls you to do in order to receive the promises that you so desperately need. And in that same way, God calls for us the same way. If we want what God offers us, we need to be ones who are going to do the things that God calls us to do. Jesus concludes that very thing in John chapter 14 and verse 15. I don't know if there's a more useful verse in all of the Bible when it comes to teaching people the truth. If you love me, keep my commandments. It doesn't get any simpler than that. If you don't keep his commandments, if you don't at least pursue keeping his commandments, then you don't really love him, no matter what you might say or think in your heart. We continue the book of Numbers. 22 through 25 is about Balak and Balaam. Balak, a king who desires dominion over the Israelites. Tell me what the secret is. And Balaam shares enough that Balak figures it out. Their weakness is their lustful thoughts. And he sends their weakness among them. And it destroys them in a lot of ways. And chapter 26 brings a second census, demonstrating the growth of the Israelites, because that's what the book of Numbers is about. Not just the moving about through the wilderness or the consequences of their travels, but in truth, it's about the development of a nation. In chapter 32, they are so close. They are so close to the end of their wandering, where they end up on the east side of the Jordan. Most people don't realize how this works. I guess I should have put a geographic picture of it up there, but you have the land of Israel, right? And I got to flip it because you guys are facing the other direction. You know, a second. And we got Egypt down here, and they come up and around. They don't go straight in, right? They could theoretically, but God brings them around the bottom, and they come up on the side of the River of Jordan. And they have to cross the River of Jordan in order to get into the land of promise. But when they conquer this area on the side, 2.5 tribes decide, this is good enough. We're okay with this. This is satisfactory for our needs. Why don't we live here? We don't want to go across the land of promise. We're okay here. And so 2.5 tribes beg Moses. And Moses goes to God, and God says, okay. Almost like, I was going to give you the land of promise, a land flowing with milk and honey, but if you don't want it, you can take this consolation prize. And they do. They take this consolation. And what we find moving forward in through the books of the Old Testament is this. This is one of the driving forces of the division among the people of God. This separation by the River of Jordan. It becomes a tenuous thing to where even it becomes a password when people are coming across and they're at odds with each other and they ask the people crossing about this word. Yeah. Shibboleth. Do you say Shibboleth or Shibboleth? And just that simple difference is enough for them to know whether you belong in the land or not. It becomes a destructive separation. And what's sad is that we can do the same thing in the church. We can allow stupid things to separate us, to divide us. We can get upset about silly things. I've seen congregations divide over they're getting new carpet and they fight over the color of it. And I suspect there was a lot more involved than the color of the carpet, just that the coloring of the carpet happened to be the straw that broke the camel's back, you might say. Because if you're going to fight over the carpet, it really says a lot about your relationship with God and your relationship with each other. But that doesn't just happen. It happens over time because people aren't doing the things they need to do. And that's what happened to the Israelites. 2.5 tribes were entirely separated forever because they refused to cross the Jordan with everyone else. Now, they were still responsible for coming over and helping to take care of the taking of the land. God makes sure that they do that. And they do. But then they go back home, and it becomes a division unto them. The last three chapters, 33 through 35 of the book of Numbers, is surveying the land. God tells them the borders of the land, the territories, and he tells them basic divisions over that land. Now, we would see at the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua taking the land, at least overall, and we'll talk about that when we talk about Deuteronomy and Joshua, which go together, in my opinion, because they're talking about the same generation of people. But at the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua not only subdivides the land ultimately, he follows God's instructions here. There's no reason to study the Old Testament if it doesn't have an application to us today, though. It's history otherwise. And as a historical account, it's fantastic, right? It's really quality work. And it follows along not only with what we understand human history to be, but ultimately what folks didn't know about human history has been revealed in the Old Testament and confirmed by archaeology, which I find really impressive. Before people even knew that these things were true archaeologically, Christians and Jews, for that matter, hundreds of years ago, knew for certain that they were true. And yet people all over the world questioned them and challenged things. And if the Old Testament is only valuable in a historical context, then it's not really that valuable altogether. I mean, how much do you value your historical books? I would have to say probably not a lot. But the book of the law, the Old Testament, the books of Leviticus and Numbers are important for a great deal more reason than simply historical significance. It's not just enough that these things really happen, and that's impressive on its own. It's more important of what they lead to in the New Testament and to New Testament Christians, because Jesus is in Leviticus and Numbers. Jesus is found in every book of the Bible ultimately, but we're talking especially here in Leviticus and Numbers. And this is not an end-all, be-all chart of all the instances by any measure. There are a lot of ways that Jesus presents himself, that God is found throughout the Old Testament. But in particular, in chapter 3 of the book of Leviticus, that line at the bottom, before 21, is the difference between Leviticus and Numbers. There's one major one in Numbers. But in chapter 3, we talked about the sacrifices and the offerings, and one of those sacrifices is the peace offering that we oftentimes overlook. When you are at odds with someone else, and especially at odds with God, there is a sacrifice that you're supposed to make. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 14. We were at odds. When God took the Israelites out of the Gentile population, it created a separation between us. And there was enmity between us and the Jews for the existence of that covenant. But then in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul would pick up on this concept from the Old Testament. In verse 14, he says, "For he himself is our peace, who has made both one, and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace." This sacrifice that you would bring, this peace offering that you would bring to God, was supposed to help reconcile you not only back to God, but in any relationship that you might have, any situation you might find yourself at odds, even with another. And Jesus did that. He sacrificed himself not only so that we might have peace with God, but that ultimately through him we might have peace with each other. Jews and Gentiles, slaves and free, males and females, we are all one in Christ Jesus. In chapter 4 of Leviticus, you have a sin offering. Obviously, that goes directly into what Jesus did for us. The sin offering in the Old Testament had to do with, this was whenever you sinned. This wasn't even the Day of Atonement. But when you sinned, there was a particular sacrifice to be made. And Jesus paid that price. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. In chapter 16, he's talking about the Day of Atonement. And involved in the Day of Atonement were two beasts. One was sacrificed, and the other was the scapegoat. And this sacrifice would be taken, it would be slaughtered, and the blood would be applied upon the head of the scapegoat. And then that scapegoat would be led out of the city and released. And with that scapegoat being released, took metaphorically their sins from the city, from the people of the day. Jesus was that scapegoat, that sacrifice. He was the one that took our sins away. And chapter 23 has to do with the Passover, an obvious connection to Jesus even makes it, a connection to the Lord's Supper. We talked about this a few weeks ago, but Jesus chose of all days, coincidentally, the day of the Passover, the day when the Israelites would be thinking about how God had taken care of them and their children, how he had passed over those houses that had the blood put on the doorpost and on the lintel. And Jesus takes that day and at the end of the Passover feast commits to them to talk to them about the Passover of sin, about how through his covenant we would have redemption of sins, that through his blood our sins would be remitted, would be carried away, that we would not be burdened by the angel of death, both physically and inevitably, spiritually, because of the Passover lamb. A lamb that was supposed to be chosen before time, that was prepared, that was slaughtered and cooked with bitter herbs, one where they would gather together in order to take of it, and one that must be perfect, pristine, without blemish and without spot. We are not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold that we received from our aimless conduct from our fathers, but we are redeemed with the blood of Christ, the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. He is that Passover lamb. He is what makes our salvation possible. In Leviticus 25, this fantastic theme of the kinsman redeemer, it's a complicated theme. Basically, your closest near relative who could take care of a debt that you owed, they could take care of that debt for you and purchase back the land that you had sold. They could restore you to where you were before these terrible things happened that caused you to sell that land. And they could bring you back into the fold of Israel. That kinsman redeemer is the very theme of the book of Ruth. As Naomi and her family, her husband, they have to depart. They sell their land to another and they go on their way to Midian. And the sons marry Midianite women, Ruth among one of them. And when they go back, Naomi has nothing. And it is Boaz who elicits this kinsman redeemer opportunity, though there was another in front of him. It all started here in the book of Numbers. The glory and the beauty of the idea of the book of Ruth is made possible because God made a plan that your nearest relative could pay the price that you couldn't. Why did Jesus come to this earth? Among other reasons, so that he could take part in this human experience, that he would be one of us, that he could redeem us as a kinsman. He could take care of that price that we owed, and he would pay it with his own life. He is that kinsman redeemer. He is what all of this led to. It is a beautiful concept. It's amazing how God had taken care of these things. There are many instances of Jesus through the book of Numbers, but I chose one in particular, which happened to be talked about this morning. Perhaps I should have chosen another one, since Larry talked about it this morning, but he did such a remarkable job. The bronze serpent. The bronze serpent that was chosen, created by Moses at God's behest, that when faith in the power of God, not in the power of the bronze serpent, but when faith in the power of God to heal, whelmed within a person who had been bitten, they could be healed from that bite and not die. All it took was faithfulness. Not just the belief, right? Any individual who got bit, they could go, yeah, I know that if I look up at that bronze serpent, but they could refuse, couldn't they? They could absolutely know. Because faith on its own, the idea of believing that it's true, is not enough. It required obedience to look upon this bronze serpent. You say, well, that's not that much more. Oh, yeah, it is, because there were probably some people who refused. Just on the grounds of principle, and they die. Can you imagine that? Maybe you know some people who are doing exactly that. We deal with people regularly who know the truth but refuse to do anything about it. And you say that it's ridiculous that some of these Israelites might not have looked up at the bronze serpent because it was so easy. Coming to Christ isn't difficult. It just requires that we obey. It requires that we obey. If we believe his promises, then we will perform his will. Jesus even talks about it. He connects himself to that bronze serpent, as Brother Larry mentioned there in John 3, 14 and 15. That he will be lifted up and that he will draw men unto him. In the end, Romans 15, 4. The things that were written before time were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. These things were not just recorded for historical value. God is not concerned with human understanding of history. He is concerned with us understanding the things that he is revealing to us so that we can make better choices, so that we can do better and greater things in this world, so that we can receive the promises that he has and we can live the life that he calls of us. These things that took place throughout the Old Testament, the bad decisions of the Israelites and the good decisions of individuals along the way, lead us to a greater and more developed relationship with God. They explain things so that we can understand them when others didn't. These things that God has revealed to us are important, and they carry us forward to a greater faith, and they make it possible that we can be better people than those who had come before us. But it requires that we spend the time in understanding. Now, you're studying the New Testament. That's fantastic. But it's going to be difficult for you to understand the New Testament fully without a consistent understanding of the Old. Because much of the New Testament is written from a perspective of understanding the Old. There are so many references through the New Testament concerning these matters, even in Leviticus and Numbers. It will benefit you in the long run, even beyond what we talked about today, to do some study in the book of Leviticus and Numbers. And it will behoove your faith to be committed to understanding the things that God has revealed to the greatest possible likeness. Because these books, they're about wandering. And frankly, that's what we're doing here. They were in a holding pattern, effectively. They had made poor choices. We on board there? Yeah. And it had caused a grievous effect. Still there, right? We're on task with the Israelites. But there was hope that they could be more if they remained faithful to God. And the same is true for you. There is a land of promise waiting for you. There is a land of hope where this life is no longer a concern, and the problems that come here are no longer an issue, where all is peace and joy and love. And we will have rest for our souls. It is available to you. And it is my great desire, and it's the desire of the congregation here, that you be saved. Whatever that means for you in the situation you are in. Whether you're at the very beginning and you need to understand what the will of the Lord is, we can help with that. Whether it is to put Christ on in baptism because you understand the changes that need to be made and you're committed to doing those changes, to repenting of your sins, confessing Him, of changing your life and putting Him first. Or if you need to come back to Him because you've walked away, because you're wandering far from Him, like the Israelites did frequently. Whatever we can help you with, I pray that you would let it be known as together we stand and sing.